Okay, we're here for the second On Track Off Road podcast, and I'm very pleased to say that I'm sitting in Sean Simpson's camper here at the Grand Prix of Benelux here in Lierop. Sean, cheers for taking some time out just to have a chat with us. Just for those, you know, I mean, Sean's been racing GPs for quite a while now. Started in 2005, is that right? I mean, 2008 was the purple patch, wasn't it? Won the British Championship and, you know, made a breakthrough, three podiums that year, was it?
Yeah, something I think like that. So. Three or four, yeah.
And then, you know, it was a factory ride after that with KTM in 2009, 2010. And then you've been pretty much like the only British rider in MX1 on a regular basis in 2011, 2012. So, I mean, Sean, the sort of feeling out there in the paddock at the moment is that it's pretty tough for MX1 riders. You know, MX2 is a rider's market. You know, you've got riders dictating those with a bit more experience, a bit more speed, a bit more, you know, results under their belt are dictating prices that are pretty big, and they're getting the best rides, as normally happens. But then in MX1, it's just a case of there's not enough saddles to go around for those that elite group that are over 23 years old, and it's a struggle. I mean, what's it like out there for you?
I think it's tough, you know. Like we've, as you said, I've made the move up to MX1, yeah, maybe a little bit earlier than I could have or should have. I had one more year left in MX2, as I was only 22 years old when I moved up. I think for me, it was the right decision at the time. There wasn't, you know, many deals left in MX2. I decided to go to MX1. It suited my style quite well. But as you say, you know, the age limit of 23 has kind of made it better in a way for some of the younger MX2 riders, and made it worse for riders of sort of my standard or my pace on the track. I think anyone between sort of, let's say, 8th and 14th in MX1 or even 12th, it's difficult then to sort of get a deal in MX1, just purely because of, as you said, the amount of saddles that are going around. I think there's more guys coming into MX1 next year from MX2, which is going to make it even tougher, as I think all three of them guys have took, you know, the factory seats, and it makes you know, my this part of the season that bit tougher, because I've got to see what's still available, see you know, if there's, you know, any coin left in their sort of, you know, pockets, and you know, try and go for something that I think that's going to really, you know, work for me. Maybe not in, you know, salary wise, but maybe in what's going to work for me as a rider and get the best results next year, and then looking forward on to the following year. So,
but is it skewed? I mean, do you think, you know, prices can be driven down, can't they? Because riders are competing against each other for, you know, maybe not for factory rides, but for well-supported rides, and you're going further and further down the tiers. I mean, it's a case where you're competing, you know, off the track and across the table rather than on the track and, you know, behind the gate.
It definitely is. I think it's even tougher for the teams next year. If you're not a factory team, even if you're well-supported, these extra two flyaway GPs just take a lot more into the consideration for the teams, saying that, you know, that the extra two flyaways, especially with the first GP being a flyaway, is going to cost them that bit more. So then they have maybe less in the pot to go after a good rider. And like you say, it does maybe drive the cost of riders down that little bit more. And people nowadays are willing to ride for that little bit less than they were maybe, say, 2 or 3 years ago. And I think it's difficult because, you know, everyone knows that it's not an easy sport. It's, you know, we're putting our life on the line every time we go out on the track. And it is a sport that really, I think, deserves to be supported more and to give more credit for what we do out on the track.
But do you think it almost needs like an overhaul of the system? The way it's been for decades has been, you do well, you get noticed, you get picked up, you get paid well, hopefully you deliver results and your career goes up and on. Do you think now it needs an overhaul where teams are going to have to look at the way they generate income? They're going to have to look at the riders they bring in. There's already some teams taking riders that are bringing money in, and that's been the case for a couple of years as well. But do you think they're going to have to look at riders now and think, well, that rider is good for me because it ticks marketing boxes, you know, and I need that sponsor because I need to get to Thailand for the first GP? I mean, do you think that's going to be more important now? Teams are going to have to look at the nationality and the skills of a rider off the motorcycle.
I definitely think that's coming more into it. you know, everyone likes to see the results on the track, everyone likes to see the speed on the track, but if the rider off the track is, you know, for want of a better word, a bit boring, or if he's, you know, if he's not too great with the camera, if he gives short answers on interviews, people don't really get to see what that rider's like. Sponsors don't get to get their full, you know, let's say money's worth out of them if they're not, you know, good at what they do off the track as well. And I think sponsors should look at that, or teams should look at that, and you know, put a plus point next to your name for that. I think.
Well, how do you feel about that? I mean, you have a big high-profile example in MotoGP, for example, where Casey Stoner didn't want to play that role, and he's gone at 27. But how do you feel? I mean, do you think, listen, this is something I'm happy to do, or I'm happy to learn more about, and that's what I need to do?
I think that's what I need to do. Yeah, I think I've got the advantage of being British. You know, the majority of the press, you know, speak English, and the majority of the websites are in English, things like that. So for myself, it's maybe that little bit easier. I feel like I try and present myself well, but there's always areas that I think that I can maybe improve on. And, you know, it's even just going down to websites and press releases and things that people don't really think about or care about that actually matter, that keeps the fans and the sponsors happy, that you know, you need to do, and you know, keep working in a direction that everyone, you know, sees as the right way to go, and to try and progress as a, you know, as an athlete. And I think that's something that a lot of people overlook, but I think it's an important part of it. And you know, as you say, it's maybe something that a lot more people should look into, including myself.
Is it something, I mean, you know, as the son of a former GP rider, is it something that you're not too happy about the way motocross has developed? I mean, you could argue that it's just nature's course, because, you know, racing needs to modernise, and this is the way it is for modern motorsport. You have to be a sellable product, and everybody's in it to showcase what they can sell. It's not a case of really rolling into the paddock now with a trailer and a little bike and hoping for some good results and having a bit of fun. I mean, it's got to pay. Like you say, there's risks involved. The risks seem to get bigger every year because of increased speeds or whatever of the bikes. You know, how do you sort of feel? I mean, are you sort of disillusioned, or are you still quite happy? You know, you want to crack on with it?
I think it's something that at the end of the day, everyone sees it as the MX World Championship. There is a great series in America that's running alongside it, that a lot of people have been tempted to go and try. But I think however it works out or whatever happens, I think everyone still want to ride the World Championship motocross. And that's how you see that people still support it, the factories are still supporting it, the teams are still supporting it, and it doesn't really seem to matter what direction it's going in, everyone just sort of follows on. And at the end of the day, it always comes down to the two races on Sunday, points for the championship, and every year you get a champion. But I think it, in some ways it does need an overhaul. I think maybe the talent that used to be there throughout 40 riders has gone. You know, I think in MX1 or MX2, you can say that there's, you know, in MX2 there's maybe 5 or 6 top riders at the moment. After that, it sort of tails off, and then maybe outside the points between 20th and 30th or 40th is guys that are, you know, able from whatever reason to give it a go, to give it a try. Whereas maybe in my father's era, it was a bit more 40 guys that were on the start gate on Sunday had earned it. They had came with 60 other riders to try and battle for them 40 positions on the line. And I feel that then you got the best racing possible, because there was maybe a local guy could come, try and qualify, and you could maybe show his speed and see that, look, this guy has got potential. And, you know, but nowadays it's a little bit more, if you've got a big team or a big name or a big sponsor behind you, then you can come in and, you know, regardless of your speed, really.
But that's a little bit more the situation in national championships now, isn't it, where you can get that big sort of plethora of riders coming and trying to, you know, make a name for themselves. But you know, I guess you're not going to get it at world championship level anymore. I mean, you can't blame the promoters for wanting to treat a world championship, you know, like a world championship, you know, the peak, the pinnacle.
I think maybe if they were going to do it like the way they've done it, it's maybe, you know, say 30 riders. It used to be 30 riders. I honestly think it's easy to say, you know, back in the day or when my dad did it, or, you know, that was the best way to do it. But I honestly think when I started GPs in the end of 04, beginning of 2005 for my first season, that the way they done it then was there was however many guys, I think maybe 50 guys were allowed to turn up, and you had the two heat races on the Saturday, you had your last chance qualifying. That made for a spectacle. It was more, I know we have a race on Saturday now, but it's more of a procession. Everyone knows they're going to qualify. Okay, if you make a mistake, you get a bad gate pick, but everyone starts on Sunday. I knew when I first started GPs, there was pressure on a Saturday to qualify, to make that Sunday morning warm-up was just, it felt great as a, you know, a young rider. And I think a lot of people miss that now. A lot of people miss the, you know, the tension of qualifying one week and not qualifying the next week, and people see that and people know that, and now all that's gone, and I just feel that, you know, an exciting part of Saturday is just missed. And I feel sometimes like, what is Saturday all about? I might as well just get out of my bed on Sunday morning, make the warm up, and do two races on Sunday. It feels like Saturday's more of a procession than actually means something.
And then you have the AMA series, which is kind of the other extreme, where they only have two practice sessions. They go straight into the time thing, and then it's the motos. You know, someone like Ken Roczen, who didn't know the tracks, that's a pretty deep end to the pool, isn't it?
I think there is the other side to it. I think I know from myself previous sort of experiences going back to British Championships or things like that, where you do only get your little bit of practice in the morning and straight into your motos, regardless if you know the track or not. Even some of the GP riders nowadays, they're just used to getting all that practice on the track. Their body's warmed up, you know, they get arm pump in the practice rather than in the first moto.
And yeah,
I think, you know, your body gets used to what you do. And, you know, we've been riding two-day events for, you know, since I started GPs, and everyone sort of gets used to that. But I'm just saying that the pressure of Saturday and the best possible guys getting the lineup on Sunday does make, you know, for something exciting, really.
I mean, I mentioned the AMA a minute ago. I mean, that's obviously a glittering series. It's the most high-profile national series in the world. I mean, the British is also a pretty important competition. I mean, I've had people maybe for the last 2 or 3 years say to me, oh, you know, why isn't Sean Simpson making a big attack on the British Championship? Why isn't he focusing his attention on Britain? Pretty much in the same way that GP riders like James Noble, Carl Mann, Stephen Sword, Tom Church have done. I mean, do you find yourself a little bit in that kind of situation now where you might have to make a choice and say, well, you know, there's just not that much left for me in GPs anymore, or I'm going to have to, you know, think about a good supported ride in the British series? I mean, what's on your mind?
I think, you know, at 24, I'd like to think that I've got a lot of years left in GPs. You know, I think it's bad to see people, you know, late 20s saying, okay, I need to hang my boots up, or I need to say, like, call it a day. I think that's, you know, not good, because there's a lot of riders went on over 30 and still were in the best years of their life, you know, and in the best shape. You know, they had a lot of experience, which you build up every year. And I feel even now I'm still learning every time I go out on the track. You know, still learn things about the tracks, about bike setup. You know, you grow as a rider and, you know, an athlete. So everyone knows as well that training side of things as well, you can learn stuff about your body, what's the best ways to train. And I feel over the last few years I've learned so much. To go and give all that up and go back to the racing British Championships or something, I think would be crazy. It's also discouraging as well to see that the British Championships or some of the other national series are taken, you know, on some of the same rules as the GPs and trying to be like a mini world championship where the teams are going to have to start paying to come along. They're going to, you know, take away the prize money and try and, you know, build up other things. But I think the main thing is that the riders coming along or the athletes riding at your event, you know, it's actually encouraging for them to come along, especially as being a GP rider. To go and do a national series is a big chunk out of your season where you could maybe take a weekend off, you could, you know, let your body recuperate.
Yeah,
it's quite important for it to be able to be something that's you know, worthy to do, you know, not only just for the you know, the training or the things like that, or you know, getting your bike set up for an oncoming GP. I think sometimes it's, you know, it needs to be worth for the rider to do, and there's bonuses then from the manufacturers or prize money from the event. And I think that's maybe where somewhere like the Belgian Championship or something like that, they actually want the best guys to come along, so they have to pay, you know, appearance money. You get the best guys on the track, and, you know, everyone then can come along and see some top GP riders, whereas if you don't do that or don't pay good prize money or teams aren't supporting it as well, then you have, okay, a British Championship or a National Series that not many people are supporting so well. And as I said already, it's difficult for a GP rider to do 16 or 17 GP races and fit in another series. So I think they need to take a close look at that as well and say, look, we want the best guys to come and do it and support it, but they need to make sure they do that in a correct way. But going back to your question, I think I've definitely got more in the tank for the GPs, and I feel like I've still got a few years left at it. And with only doing my second year in MX1, I still feel I'm learning stuff about the MX1 side of things, you know, in regard to the MX2.
I mean, last year you rode, supported Honda, and then this year you've been on the factory Yamaha, you're 10th in the world. I mean, that's no mean feat considering how stacked the class is. You know, there's a lot of good riders out there. You know, I've known you for quite a while now, and I could see kind of how disappointed you were, like in Mataley last 2 weeks ago, when the Nations team, Team Great Britain for the Motocross of Nations on September the 30th was announced, and you were kind of the fourth rider, you know, the outside pick. I mean, can you just sort of let me know, I mean, what's your thoughts on it now? Is it a case of like, oh, never mind? Or, you know, you just still feel a little bit harshly done by?
I do. I think it's something that, you know, any good rider deserves a spot in the team. You know, there's obviously a handful of guys that were chosen to begin with to pick from. I felt like I was, you know, a top three rider that should have been picked for the team.
Yeah, you must have been at the top on the shortlist, you know. I mean,
I think it's something that, as every rider would say, they'd be privileged to ride for their country. I think, as you said there, it's not something that I'm like, oh, well, you know, I didn't make the team again. There's always next year. I'm still feeling to this day a little bit sort of, you know, miffed about it, to be honest, because I feel that my speed is good enough in the sand. You know, we've got a sand race this weekend in Lierop. I've been waiting for this race for a long time, and you know, here's hoping it goes well, not just for myself, but to just try and say to the guys that, you know, picked the team that, you know, you shouldn't have looked past me. I know maybe I've not been setting the world alight, but as you said, 10th in the World Championship in MX1. You know, not many people see that MX1 is so stacked, and if you get a bad start, it is hard to come through. Whereas, you know, in MX2 or in MX1 in the past, guys could come back into the top 10 because the field wasn't just quite as good. And it's difficult to try and understand why that decision's been made for the third place in the British team. But I think, you know, there's obviously decisions that have been made behind closed doors that have you know, swayed the decision. And, you know, you have to respect that at the end of the day. But I think they had missed an opportunity with myself, as I've got the factory bike from Rinaldi, would have been supported for the Nations, and you know, I live 10 minutes from the place. I've been putting in motos there all year, and I really feel like I could have done something special for the team, not only you know, to try and get us on a good result, but work to good together. And I feel like I'm a, you know, not a veteran of course, but like a, you know, a worthy, mature rider who, you know, doesn't normally make too many big mistakes or throw it away. So I think it's probably would have been a good choice.
Well, I mean, like you said in the press conference in Mataley, which I thought was pretty impressive, you know, there's still races to go. I mean, there's still 6 Grand Prix motos, and you wouldn't want to wish bad on anyone, but you know, there's still a chance you could step in. So you probably don't want to be slagging off the federation and their choices or the people behind the team at all, I guess. I mean, there's still a chance you could ride there, because, like you say, it would be, the circumstances are favourable.
Yeah, I think it's, as I said, as you've just quoted, there is a lot of races to go. Everyone knows that motocross is a dangerous sport, and things do happen. So I can only say that I hope nothing happens to anybody, but I'm willing to step in as I'm the reserve rider. So it's just a waiting game for myself to see if you know, I need to be called up or brought in at the last minute. But
I mean, people know you're good in the sand. I mean, you won your GP moto in Valkenswaard in 2009, but this track here in Lierop's not been too kind to you, from what I can remember. Did you break a leg here, or was it a shoulder as well? Was that 2 years?
Yeah, both. I done both.
And you'd do some luck at this track.
Yeah, I did. 2005 was my first event here. I was just cruising, and I broke my fibula on my left leg coming through the rhythm section. Yeah. I was actually due to pull into the pit. Following season, I thought, okay, here we go. I was on Honda again that season, Wolfsport Honda. And first lap of the last chance, I was the last chance king that year. And I just slipped out on a corner and broke a collarbone. The following year then, I managed to get round with no real dramas. You know, I didn't finish great results. 08, I think I was two times fifth or two times sixth. 09 then, I think two times sixth again.
That wasn't bad because you broke your leg that year. So
I did,
missed, yeah. 4 months you missed or something?
Yeah, I did. I missed a good chunk of the season. Come back, probably one of the toughest races of the year. So I was reasonably happy with that result. I'd been putting the time in the sand. But yeah, overall, I've not had any great results here. But every time I come here, I just smile. And even looking at the track today, I just, you know, really enjoy the layout here. I know from what everyone can see, it looks so smooth and so great.
It's not going to be like that one, yeah.
I keep telling people that haven't been here before, they say, is it really that rough? And I just say, just you wait till the second moto on Sunday, yeah. Or walk it Sunday night and you'll be amazed that what a motocross bike, how much dirt just a motocross bike can move with berms, with bumps, and big holes. It's just, it amazes me every time I see it.
Do you think the Americans are in for a shock at Lommel? Because, I mean, this is very kind of shifting and ripply sand, but it's a little bit hard underneath in some places. But Lommel's just like an endless pit, really, isn't it? I mean, I'm a little bit critical of that circuit anyway, because I feel by the end of the motos, by the end of a 35-minute plus two-lap motos, the guys are just riding around. They're just like battling against the track rather than fighting for positions, it seems, you know. You know, these guys can ride anything. They're going to be fast. They're going to be in contention for, like, I think an eighth straight victory. But it's going to be a little bit of an eye-opener, do you think?
I think for sure. It's something that America doesn't seem to have. They have sand races, but I've never been to Southwick. A lot of the guys say that it's nothing compared to Lommel or it's nothing compared to Lierop. I wouldn't know until I went there myself. But I do feel that they will be in for a bit of a shock. I mean, they're not stupid guys. They'll have done their homework and they'll have been putting in time, you know, in the dunes or wherever it might have to be. I think they'll come prepared. They'll be ready. Whether they'll be that much better than they seem to be than everyone else each year, they seem to be so consistent. Whether they'll might make some mistakes or whether another team can be strong, I'm not exactly sure. What, yeah, I can
just unplug my laptop then.
Yeah, looks like. Right. I hope it didn't mess it up. I think that then, you know, they will come. They will give their best, and I'm sure that they'll be still the team to beat. But whether or not they'll make any falter, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But should be interesting. It's something that we've not seen for a long time. There's a lot of unknowns, but I hope, yeah, that someone can put a stop to their streak. Just to make it a bit more exciting, to be honest.
I mean, just to wrap this up, Sean, I mean, you're from a big motocross family and you can see how much of a fan you are of this sport. I mean, it'll be really encouraging to see a figure like you get a good deal for next year. I mean, it's, how kind of confident are you that you're going to be back here racing GPs on a level that you'll be happy with? I mean, is it 50-50 in the balance at the moment, or do you think, you know, look, it's going to be a couple of weeks but I'm going to pull something out of the bag?
I think it's just going to be a couple of weeks yet. I feel that although I'm a, you know, a worthy rider of a good spot, I think it's still got to the point in, you know, time as we've talked about, where I'm one of those riders that's got to wait for the better riders to sort of place themselves. I know that sounds maybe, you know, bad to myself or you know, like, yeah, I'm not worthy of a good
defeatist
spot. Nah. But at the same time, I still feel there is possible rides out there, and I still feel there is a good 90% chance that I can pull something out the bag here and really give it my best shot. I think it's going to be something that maybe it's not going to be the best financially for myself, but I honestly think that there is teams out there which can give me the tools I need to bring the results home. And I think as much as everyone wants the financial side of things or the glory or the lifestyle, for me it's really about getting the results on track and doing the best I can and using my body as a you know, a tool with the bike to bring the best results. And I know how much work I put in during the week, and for things to be just about right is difficult. I want it just to be where I'm, you know, an actual one with the bike at one and work work good through the week as well and bring them things to the weekend and show the guys that I can battle with them, that I can go forward in races. And you know, there's been so many times where little things have happened and I go drop back a little bit and try and fight forward, you know, ironing out all them little creases and just, you know, giving my best shot in 2013 and really showing people that, you know, maybe I should be one of them factory riders again.
Oh. All right, Sean, well, thanks for talking to us. And, of course, you know, huge luck with it. I hope something comes off, especially this weekend as well.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, for the second part of this podcast, I'm joined by Paul Malin, expert TV commentator, former Grand Prix winner again. Thanks, Paul, for popping over here to the press room in the the depths of the night here in Benelux, the Grand Prix of Benelux and Leer Upstel in the Netherlands. The main talking point today, it's got to be one person, really, isn't it?
And for once, it's not Tony Cairoli.
Yeah.
It's his teammate, Jeffrey Herlings. I mean, what a phenomenal ride the guy put in. Normally, when we come to these races, you hear one or two stories, rumours going around, all the rest of it, what certain people want to do. But he had a plan. He wanted to lap everybody today. And I guess the most exciting thing that happened for him all weekend was not the way he rode today, but maybe the qualifying race yesterday. That really set the precedent, didn't it? You know,
yeah.
Crashing at the first turn, second turn, and coming from 30 seconds back in a 25-minute moto to win it by 5 or 6 seconds. You know, we knew then.
Yeah, that was a preview.
If we got a good start, we knew then that the rest of the field would be in trouble. And I cannot believe how easy he made it look. Seriously,
yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Well, he was actually wearing a butt patch on his pants that said something like, "Got your back."
Then best friends forever,
yeah. And you kind of, well, I mean, that was a very nice sentiment, of course, but you kind of think, well, you know, maybe he had a plan. He thought he could lap everybody apart from Van Horbeek, and then he would literally be behind him, and that would be it. I mean, it kind of went perfectly to plan in the first moto. For people who are listening in, Jeffrey Herlings didn't win this Grand Prix. He absolutely decimated it. I don't think in 12 years of covering every Grand Prix, I've never seen such a dominant performance. Somebody who was completely at one with every element there was around him, the fans, the track, the bike. It was quite sensational.
It was a demolition job. It really was. We didn't see too much of him, but the bits that we did, it was all about watching him compared to the other riders and his technique in the sand. I mean, we've compared riders against other riders in the past. Stefan Evans was arguably in his generation the best sand rider, and then of course before that it might have been let's say Eric Gabors the kid, or maybe even I don't know, Kees van der Ven or people like that. But you know, that's going back a fair while, but no one has ever seen anything as phenomenal as what we saw today. And in fact, just before we came in, I was just looking at my Facebook page and looking at some of the comments there. There was a comment by Alex saying, you know, and it was basically a link to his page, just saying, you know, the best sand rider bracket, you know, ever. And then you read the comments on there, and it was a case of, you know, people still arguing about Stefan. But what he did was just unheard of. And somebody said, has this been ever seen before?
Yeah,
and there was reference to maybe Jackie Vimond in the mud, lapped up to third in the mud in 1986 or something like that. But this is sand. It's different. And the thing is, the other riders aren't bad riders in sand. You know, I made a comment in the commentary that all these other guys in MX2 probably felt, actually, you know, I'm doing pretty good. I'm riding good. I feel good. I'm at one with the bike. And then suddenly, you know, 10 minutes to go, 15 minutes to go, 3 laps to go. Even Tommy Searle is being lapped in moto number one. And Max Anstey, who finished third. And it was just insane what we saw today.
You know, I mean, for those people who didn't, you know, actually catch, you know, this 14th round of 16 in the World Championship live, I mean, grab it on YouTube, because it was a very special moment. The extent of the way Herlings just took the mickey basically here today, you could tell by the fact that Tommy Searle rode so well and won the last round 2 weeks ago in Medley Basin, beat Jeffrey Herlings. But here it was like I don't know, he was on an 85 or something, because
well, even in the second race, Tommy Searle made the whole shot, ran wide, Herlings put it across him going through turn two, and after what happened in race one, we just knew that Tommy wouldn't have the tools to stay with him. I mean, at the end of the first lap, he was 7 seconds down. At the end of the official first lap, which was lap two, it was 14 seconds. So even in the first two laps, he was 7 or 8 seconds quicker than Tommy.
Yeah.
And Tommy was pulling away from the guys in third. So it was just, you know, you can't imagine 7 or 8 seconds of that quicker on any other racetrack. And when you say it out loud, you think, how can anybody imagine that in Formula One? That's almost half a lap.
Yeah, why can't he explain it? I've asked him, you know, even at Valkenswerth, where he's unbeaten since he's come to the World Championship. You know why? I asked him in the press conference as well. I said, you know, you saw every rider because you passed them. You know, what are you doing that's different to them? And he was a bit of a loss. I'm sure if he sat down and broke it down one day, he can probably say, well, I'm doing this, I'm hitting that particular kind of berm, or I'm, I don't know, maybe it's just all down to rhythm.
Yeah, I mean, from having ridden the sand and having won a race, the Dutch Grand Prix in 91 in sand, and knowing how to ride sand a little bit, you know, from what I can see of Geoffrey Herlings and what I've seen of Stefan Evans, I mean, I even picked up stuff up from Stefan Evans back in 96 that I'd never seen before. And the biggest area that I can see where he makes the gain, you know, we can all say stand up and sit on, you know, and hang over the back and all the rest of it, but he doesn't really do that. Yes, he's on the pegs. As soon as he gets out of a corner, if he sat down, it's very brief up on the pegs and that's it. But the way he's working on that bike, he's using a lot of legs to help suck up the bike as it, you know, as he's hitting stuff. He's absorbing a lot of stuff, taking a lot of energy from the bike. So he's working very, very hard, even though he makes it look very, very easy. But the other thing is as well, you know, he's not afraid, and that's a lot. That's a big problem for a lot of people. They go, "Oh, Lierop, sand." Mentally, they're already beat before they get here. Whereas Geoffrey, it's a confidence thing. It's like, Lierop, what's the problem? Bring it on. And when you watch him ride, you know, his upper body strength in the way that he muscles the bike around, when he hits the braking bumps coming into corners, he's not hitting them all with the front wheel first. He's picking the front up, wheeling over the last few, dropping it over the last one, railing the corner. And in the corners, he's not going too deep. He's not rushing it. He's not burying the bike in the sand and killing it like a lot of guys. When you do that, you're losing energy, you're knocking the wind out of your own sails, and you're losing time and space again. Whereas he's just at the base of the berm, getting on the gas a lot earlier. A lot of it's going to be to do with bike setup as well, you know, in terms of suspension setup and gearing and that kind of thing. Van Horbeek would have had exactly the same bike, believe you me. But even then, he was six seconds a lap slower.
I was kind of standing for a little bit on that first turn, and it just seemed like the bike was had a lot of torque, a lot of bottom end. He was just ripping through that, you know. That was probably the slowest corner on the track, and just coming out of there, it sounded like, you know, he was almost on a 350 or something.
And again, don't hear this too often, when he lapped Jake Nicholls in the second race, you could see then through the finish line area. That's right, just one or two people clearing up here on Sunday night with the last ones in it almost. But on the point that I just made there, Jake Nicholls, he lapped Jake. He went through behind him on the finish line. Then it was it was more than 90 degrees, isn't it, from there, going through that left-hander.
Yeah.
He came in nice and wide, hit a couple of braking bumps at the end, and as soon as he got it laid over, he literally just got on the gas, and it's almost like he quick-shifts from, like, second to third, while the other guys are maybe hanging a gear too long as well. Yeah. So he's really using that torque, as you said. And before he even knew it, Jake looked across and was like, "You again?" Oh my God, you know, you're back. So at that point, Jake just backed off and just let him have it, because why contest it?
I mean, something I didn't quite realise, and what Herlings explained afterwards, is that this was the first time he's raced here, like in a GP. First season, he dislocated his shoulder in Czech Republic, so he missed the late trip, because Lierop's always traditionally in September or right at the end of the calendar. Last year we weren't here, so this was the first Grand Prix.
Yeah, it's always been Valkenswaard.
And now it's a case of, well, this is just another kind of stamp. I was going to say, it's part of his home, his territory.
Yeah, well, he's always said, he was born at Geldrop down the road, wasn't he? And then, or somewhere close to here anyway. But doesn't really live in this area now, spends a lot of time in Belgium. But in terms of, you know, when he's won in the sand, let's say in Latvia, or on the sand in Valkenswaard, you know, it's soft, but it's got quite a firm base to it. So he's always said, it's sand, but it's not a Lommel or a Lierop. And I've reeled that out a few times. And when you come here and you see why, you know, he might only win a race by 30 seconds in Valkenswaard or a minute. Well, here it was 2 minutes and 7 and 2 minutes and 4 in both races, respectively. You know, had the race been another two laps, definitely he would have lapped Jeremy Van Horbeek. Definitely. I don't care what the butt patch says, you know, it would have, "I'm sorry, dude, I'm coming through," because I just want to, you know, if he was in that situation, that position where he could have, I think he would have.
I think he it was up to 15th in the first moto. He lapped people twice.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite phenomenal, really. For a young kid, you think, well, I'm going to get Grand Prix points. You know, I'm 16, 17, 18, but I've also just been lapped on two occasions by the race winner.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at people that he probably did lap twice who were picking up those 6 points and whatever. We're talking, okay, Julian Lieber, maybe Dylan Ferrandis.
Okay, on a factory Suzuki.
On a factory Suzuki as well, yeah. You know. And a rider from Belgium, okay, probably from the south, so a bit more hard pack. But Belgium's Belgium, you know, you go riding, a lot of the guys develop engines now in the sand.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's just how it is. But, yeah, what we saw today was just, I mean, I couldn't believe it. And when you watch the way that he's dancing his way through, like, okay, there's probably people here who may have never seen the racetrack, but if you do get a chance to YouTube it and look again, about halfway around the first lap, there's a bit of a kink at the end of the straight, and then it's a downhill wave section, about five or six gigantic waves. Everyone else pretty much was coming out of the left and hitting the first one, you know, front wheel first, dipping into it, maybe yeah. trying even to wheelie into it. He was getting on the gas early and using a little hook somewhere just to launch his way over it. So he was doubling the first. So again, he was, you know, he was pulling back 3/4 of a second there alone.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, because he had that momentum, it was, you know, skip, 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 double, double, out the end. And then he had that momentum to push him through the next corner to the next jump and beyond yeah. there. And that's the areas. When you break it down and you look at it in slow-mo and whatever, yeah. that's where he makes his time.
Say, you know, a track like this, I mean, it does shift around. It does change a lot, especially between sessions. Perhaps not so much this year during the race, but you can break it down into sections. You can say, right, well, that corner there, this section here, that corner there, and that kink, four areas, you know, if I can just like go through there with a little bit better line, get someone to video it, look afterwards, you can think, well, there's half a second, there's 3/4 of a second, 1 second. I mean, he had 5 seconds a lap.
Yeah.
And it was
seven.
I mean, there's two important things that have come out of this this Grand Prix today in MX2. Geoffrey Herlin is in lapping Tommy Sell after finishing second to him 2 weeks ago. He's pretty much said, that's it for the title.
Yeah.
You know, this is mine. Yeah, I mean, it's been close in Grand Prix wins. I think he's only got two more than Tommy, or maybe three. But he's got double moto victories than Tommy's got. And, you know, even though the pair have been pretty tight on points all through the year, and Tommy Sell's had his bad luck with DNFs, you know, it's been Herlin's his party pretty much from the first couple of races.
Yeah.
And today, just, you know, passing Tommy Sell there, who was pretty powerless, and said to me afterwards that he just needed a little bit more time preparing.
Yeah.
And perhaps he sort of underestimated a little bit how much more he needed to do to be ready for here. You know, that's the title pretty much in the bag. I mean, I'm not sure how many points Herlin's needs from the last race.
I think he's 65 now, so if after the first race he's 75 points clear.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean, if he scores 10 more than Tommy in the first race, that's pretty much it, because
yeah.
then it'll go down to race wins and yeah. GP victories. So what's the difference there between first and a sixth or a fifth or something like
the,
that?
Round 15, the penultimate Grand Prix, only in 6-7 days time. So hard pack, fines are very narrow, quite tight. It was going to go down to the starts.
But the thing really there is, when you just said a minute ago, it's pretty much got one hand on the trophy. It's Jeffrey's to lose now. Doesn't have to push. You know, he's done the pushing this weekend. He's proved his point. He's got the most wins, 16, I think, in a season now for him this year, as in between him and Tommy.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, Tommy can go out and win both races, but that's not going to be enough if Jeffrey comes home second or third in both motos.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then obviously, you know, that shifts us to MX1 with Cairoli as well. Both guys can take titles next weekend.
And the last time we were in Faenza, what the last time? Last time it was absolutely rain battered. But the,
oh, we know
the occasion
how...
before that was Tyler Rattray's
KTM 2008.
MX2 party. So it's, you know, quite a nice little venue for KTM.
But going back to the mud then, if it does rain and it's anything like the first race we had in 2009, then it's Tommy Searles all the way, and Jeffrey's maybe going to be swimming around in the mud. And hey, it might even go to the final round. But, you know, all joking aside, yeah, really, it's Jeffrey's well and truly in the driving seat. I'd always said after Sweden, before we even got to Latvia, where Tommy had his two DNFs, you know, unexpected DNFs. And to be fair, Jeffrey's a DNF in the second moto as well, because you don't really see the KTM's break either.
No.
That, you know, somebody said to me, you know, what does Tommy need to do to win the title? And I said he needs to be leaving Mattily, having won both races, but he needs to be 6 or 8 points clear or somewhere in the region of to come here 2 weeks later knowing that he's going to get his butt kicked. But then it just depended on how healthy Joel Roulance would be. Obviously he wiped himself out of the game 2 weeks ago. What kind of a challenge would come from Van Horbeek and that kind of thing. So because then, you know, those 8 points, 6 or 8 points, you kind of get that lost, and then it becomes a two-race shootout then, Faenza and Teuschental. Yeah, but obviously that disappeared a long time ago when he had those two DNFs, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a moot point now. I mean, I think really only the last thing we can pick out of the hurling's dominance today is Motocross of Nations coming up. I mean, he's going to be riding possibly...
Did you hear what he said after the race? After the second race, in his post-race interview? Just literally, Amy got in there and she said, you know, congratulations on winning the Grand Prix, blah, blah, blah. And he just said, yeah, you know, I guess it was pretty easy, but I'm looking forward to the Nations, riding a 350, beating the Americans and beating Tony.
Well, there you go. You know... I mean, you would say that after like lapping everybody in MX2 up until third. I mean, it's going to be scary as well next year when he loses Tommy Searle, loses Joel Roulance, loses Van Horbeek. I really think, you know, they ought to give him some sort of handicap, make him start in the waiting zone or
well,
something.
Well, this then becomes another thing. You know, we look at record books all the time. You know, Stefan with his 101 victories, 10 world titles. Tony Cairoli now, 52 Grand Prix victories. You know, however many race wins he's got and all the rest of it, going for title number 6, that'll tie him second with Joel Robert. And then you look at how many wins in a season. If there isn't the challenge, then Geoffrey Herlings could, if he's in the frame of mind that he's in at the moment, could win every moto and every round. And
a perfect season.
And that could be a perfect season. And I don't think that's...
Has it been done in Europe to your memory?
I don't think it hasn't. I know Dave Thorpe won every moto in a British Championship, 8 rounds, 16 motos or something like that, or 24 motos or whatever it was, but that was 85. But in terms of...
Stefan Evans won 14 Grand Prix from 15 in 2006.
Yeah, Coppins.
Yeah.
But obviously then it'd be 16 rounds or 17 rounds next year. So again, even if he didn't do the perfect season, he's... could be in a position where he could take the most wins in a season anyway, by virtue of the fact that we've got an extra race.
We'll talk about MX1 in a minute because, you know, you mentioned Tony Cairoli there and he obviously won again today, 6 straight wins. But the last thing I want to pick out of the hurling thing is, of course, the link to the Motocross of Nations. Lommel's a different kind of sand. It's a bit sort of thicker and it's a lot deeper. But, you know, he said in the press conference afterwards it's not confirmed whether he'll be riding a 450 or a 350. My guess is he's going to make a test before Belgium.
And is this to do with the fact that Ryan Dungey is riding a 450 and making it work
he's in the open class, so I think I'm trying to work out and remember the order.
We're talking hurlings now, aren't we?
Yeah. That's, if he's riding open, does that mean he's back-to-back races or he's got the breather? No, because it's MX1 that has the breather.
Yeah, MX2 are back-to-back because it's the first race is MX1, MX2.
Yeah.
Then it's MX2 and MX Open, and then MX1 and MX Open.
Yeah, so it's MX1 that has the break.
Yeah.
So Herlings, whatever he's riding, a 350 or 450, he's doing back-to-back motos.
And I'm sure that he could do that, and I think the smart money would be the 350, just because it's a little bit lighter, it's just got that little bit more power than a 250, that gets him out of trouble. I mean, we saw how phenomenal he was on a 250. Not sure I'd like to see him on a 450 just yet. I'm sure he'd make it work just as well, but I think the 350 would be the perfect bike if he had exactly the same machine as Tony, which I'm sure he will have.
And I don't care if you want to sort of mould, you know, Chad Reed, Ryan Villopoto and Ryan Dundee together. I think if Herlings rides like he does today, then no one's going to beat him in a moto. Whether the Dutch can get on the podium is another question mark. But, you know, the other thing is, you know, for Herlings, it's... I think the only thing that could really stop him is himself, maybe a little bit of pressure, a little bit of head, you know, and also if he has an issue with the bike.
Yeah, and that was always the worry, even coming here to the Grand Prix. You know, after he won his first Dutch round in 2010, which people thought, yeah, maybe he can win a moto, could he win both? And he did, and he's yet to lose a Dutch Grand Prix, I think, in you know, since 2010, so in 3 years. The worry has always been when he comes out with the comments before, like he came out with before this weekend, I want to lap everybody. That would be the plan. You know, then obviously he retracted the statement pretty quickly in the press conference after the qualifying race, where he said, you know, yeah, I'd like to win by a minute, and then, but it doesn't matter if I win by a minute or a second, it's 25 points, that's the important thing.
Yeah.
It's he has the ability to trip himself up. I mean, even when he crashed yesterday in that qualifying race, did you see when he came over the tabletop? That's obviously coming out of turn three, over the first Monster Energy tabletop into turn four. He took a cheeky look back.
Yeah, it was almost a whip as well.
And a look back as if to say, right, I'm out of here, and then lost it in the next turn. So that was a lesson, you know. Yeah. No showboating on the first lap. And it's always going to be, because of the precedent that he's now set himself, and everybody now expects him to raise his game in the sand. You know, maybe he can he go any quicker in the sand? I don't know. On a 350, he probably can. But, you know, for the duration that he did, like 19 laps or 18 laps, whatever both races were, he was pushing. He was doing times at the end of the second race, 206s, that Tommy Searle, Van Horbeek and everybody else were struggling to do at the start of the race. Yeah. That gives you some indication. So even though his times slowed by about 6 or 7 seconds, so did everybody else's, but they were doing, you know, 212s, 213s to his 206, so his time at the end of the race was the same as theirs. Yeah. So
it was the same margin of dominance all the way through, wasn't it?
Yeah, and obviously it's like I say, it's his to trip himself up over, you know, because he can get overconfident. He can go in there going, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
At that speed that he's travelling, it just, all it needs for him is pick up the front wheel just a little bit too long, over three or four of those, miss it down the wrong hole at the wrong time, and that is going to be a big crash, a crash for him. But he's the one that's in control. Maybe he knows what he's doing.
Maybe he's done all that crashing when he was 12, 13 and got it, you know, like he's...
Or Falcons Wild last year.
But, you know, one thing I do, going back to what you said, about what he had said in the press conference, one thing I do like about Herlings is the way his brain and his mouth just connect instantly. Mm. And he'll say something that's a little bit risky, a bit controversial, and then he'll have a think, and they think, well, I'll track that and I'll change what I said, even if it's on Facebook, Twitter,
yeah, I think
whatever.
That's KTM getting into him a little bit now, but, though, maybe,
you know, he's 17 years old. That's going to come out of him as he gets older and more professional and whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, he's achieved a lot by the age of 17 that many world have spent a decade doing. And
Well, I spent 12 years going for a world title and never won one. You know, people try even longer and never get close. You know, so it's, you know, you do get some guys that are very, very talented. Herlings is just the latest in the recent line. Of course, before that we had Ken Rocks, and before that we had Marvin Muscan, you know, so...
Yeah, someone made a comment to me the other day that the golden generation is coming to an end. I thought, well, maybe it's a little bit harsh on people like Dylan Ferrandis. And one
I think he's a great
emerge.
Kid. But, and even here today, this weekend, you know, he put himself in good positions, got good starts, Dylan Ferrandis, the Rockstar Bud Racing Kawasaki rider. Just got unfortunate in the first race where he overcooked it in the wave section, lost his foot, lost his balance, and then threw it down, and then he never really recovered from that. But, you know, fair play, he came back in the second race, and he's shown that he can also ride in the sand as well as the hard-packed tracks. And I think next year we'll see Dylan Ferrandis take it to another level, and he'll be on the podium week in, week out.
It is going to be the chase for the podium spots in MX2 next year. But moving on to MX1, Tony Cairoli, 6 wins, I think, on the trot. I think that's his most winningest streak in the World Championship.
For a while, apart from winning MX2.
Yeah, it was it 2007? He might have done 6 as well. But but Tony, literally on the edge of a major, major weekend in front of the Italian fans. David Philipparts took the championship in, I think, some of the most dramatic circumstances I've seen in MX1. You know, went right down to the last moto, down to the last couple of corners. And
With him and Ramon and Dedeiker also had an outside chance. That's where Nagel really sort of stepped it up as well, took his first two race wins. But
it's an Italian party.
It could be again. And the thing was as well about that, it could have been a double Italian party because that was a year as well that Cairoli was challenging Tommy and Tyler Rattray for that championship, did his knee in South Africa. And obviously that room, what could have been a double celebration. But I think the fans will come out in full force, definitely, because there's going to be no better feeling. And he hasn't done that yet, you know, winning a world title at home. I think it'll be a lot different to winning on the two occasions that he won here.
Brazil, Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And when was the last? Was last year? Where were we last year when he won?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. It just seems such a long time ago. But it was Geldorf.
Yes, it
with him and Roxon both winning in Geldorf around
two,
early.
Two, was it round early or two rounds?
It was round early, wasn't it? Because he didn't ride then the following week in Faenza.
Family bereavement.
Infermo. Yeah.
You know, we talked about the genius of Geoffrey Herlings, but Tony Cairoli for me is at the height of his powers.
Of course he is.
It's quite staggering. you know, how far the guy is ahead of everyone else. And I think Max Nagel said after the race in post-race interview that he doesn't understand how
in race one,
you know, how he can just be so fit and keep pushing when everyone else is tiring.
Yeah,
and you know, the staggering thing as well, Paul, is that the guy is not a beefed up Superman. No. I mean, he's not on some sort
but
of.
But he's strong though. I mean, you look at climbers, for instance. You know, absolutely skinny as a rake, skinny as a long distance runner. But the strength they've got in, you know, every little sinew in their body, you know, is just strength and muscle and everything else. And you see him, yeah, okay, I don't go around sort of looking at guys with their tops off, but there's been shots, you know, produced in the last couple of years where he's been training and he's absolutely ripped, you know, there's not an ounce of fat on him. And it's all strength, you know.
But the guy's not like a, he's not a dedicated gym scientific, a loving kind of approach to it. I mean, the other night,
but neither was John Michelle Bale.
No, true. I mean, you could, he's one of the few you can compare him to, I think. But I mean, the other night, I think it was Friday evening, we were in the parking and we saw him and Lupino and Ricardo, his practice mechanic, who were having a game of football in the parking B. And I just thought, the guy's a legend, you know. It's just, he just seems to. He does what he wants. He's in a perfect team setup, you know, with Claudio De Carli there, like he's been since 2004. And it's the guy. When the guy's happy, he's unstoppable.
But I think that comes with confidence as well. You know how strong you are physically, mentally. You know how you can ride certain conditions. So, yeah, you know, that's maybe another sort of ploy, another piece of gamesmanship on Cairoli's part.
Yeah.
You know, how many people leaving the circuit? Struggling with the conditions in the qualifying race, going, got this to look forward to tomorrow twice, two times 35 minutes plus two.
Yeah.
And he's just having a kick around, even if it was for 5 minutes. I'm sure enough people knew one of them, you know, would have driven by and thought, is he real?
Yeah,
you know, most people have had their dinner. You know, most people are thinking about having dinner and getting an early night and just trying to get a massage and stuff. And he's there taking the mic, having a kick around in B parking with a couple of Italians.
I said to him in the hospitality and it's there, so do you enjoy your kickabout? He said, yeah, why didn't you come over? Because we had a good football match a couple of years ago in Brazil, like for the last GP. And I said, are you going to go tonight? He goes, oh, yeah, maybe. That's all, you know, like Saturday afternoon. It was,
going back to your comment about what you said about Max Nagel post-race interview, race one, Cairoli was about 8th place, 9th place, didn't make a good start, got boxed in through the first turn, but for the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes, he was in no hurry.
Yeah, he wasn't going.
You know, he knew what was happening ahead, and really since Nagel's come back, that's been the biggest carrot for him, and he could probably just see him just like he did in, I think it was Matterley. In the first race, maybe.
Yeah.
Just starting to sneak away and thought, right, I'm going to flick the switch now and I'm going to go. And obviously here in the sand, again, he's got a great record. 2 world titles, he's clinched here, he's won races here and rides in conditions like this all the time. And he just really decided, right, I'm going to go. I think he passed Gauthier Paulin and Kenda Dyker in the same lap.
Yeah.
You know, went from 4th to 2nd and then closed down Max. Not massively straight away, but, you know, about a second here, then one lap he went 3 seconds quicker and then was in 3 seconds of him. And then the next lap he was all over the back of him and then he just made an easy pass at the end of the avenue, you know, the first long straightaway out into the forest.
And like picking the bones from those races, it's a case of Red Bull KTM, their three riders really hitting a hot streak of form and nobody else, everybody's having little problems and struggling. It's worth pointing out from this Grand Prix that in MX1, Evgeny Bobrychev for the factory Honda Motocross, World Motocross team, finished 4th, which I think is his best finish so far this season. In 5th place was Monster Energy Yamaha's Sean Simpson. Mm-hmm. So two riders there getting inside the top 5, enjoying their best results, but it's still, you know, those KTMs ahead. And Tanner Leop, of course, 3rd position, first podium of the year, first podium on a Suzuki.
You know, I was pleased for him. He came onto RMX Live TV show after 20 minutes after his 4th place in Moto number 1, and because he was there early, I just thought, okay, we'll speak to Tanner first, you know, get him done so he can get out and get himself, you know, changed and fed and watered for race 2 and everything else. And he was feeling confident even then after the race. You know, he said his fitness was good towards the end of the race and that was that. And then when he got a good start, he's one of those riders actually that, you know, pre-season when he picked up that injury and obviously that bothered him, you know, quite a bit, hampered his preparation and we didn't see the best of him. And you know, that and the fact that he hasn't been getting good starts when he should have been getting good starts, he's definitely got the material for it, you know, has gone against him. But this weekend, for whatever reason, whether it's contract time again, I don't know, but you know, he got good starts.
It's the sand as well for him, Paul. It's the sand. I mean, Sylvain Gavors, I was speaking with him on Saturday, and he said he doubts he's seen a harder working rider in his team. And for a person that's had the quantity of riders like Greg Albertsen, Joel Smets, Mikel Bichon, that's quite a statement. And you know, for Tanner, it's he's one of those nomads, really. He seems to chop and change every year when it comes to different teams, different bikes. But you know, I think if you're going to be critical, he's not quick enough in the first couple of laps. That's why we haven't seen him more on the podium. But today he didn't really have a rival, and he just pushed and passed and flew past Sean Simpson in that second race and took third place.
I was thinking as well, when he started to close in on Clément de Sal, I was thinking, right, team orders, still a mathematical chance that de Sal can still win the championship. But then, you know, do you take points off your teammate, yes or no? But at the end of the day, you know, it's a difficult position for him to be in, because loyalty will go so far, and the loyalty with Suzuki will go as far as the Motocross of Nations this year, you know, because obviously he's in the shop window. He needs to find a ride for 2013, and to do that he needs to get as many points as possible to get as high up the championship table as he can in the next three races. And if today is a springboard for him, then fair enough, fair play to him. You know, DeSalle's riding injured as well, so you can't just hang behind him.
That was another one of the news things to come out of the Grand Prix today. Clément de Sal, I think, riding to only sixth overall, dealing with some pain in his right hand. He said he had an injection just to numb the pain, but he's just lacking a little bit of confidence in prep time. That's what he said, in the sand. And then, you know, also a little bit on the injury list, Christophe Porcel. He was third in the championship standings, now been overtaken by Gauthier Paulin. Apparently, according to some French media colleagues, Christophe's got a bit of a fracture in his shoulder blade.
From Mattoli.
From 2 weeks ago. So that was an injection before, one yesterday and one today. And he couldn't cope with it. I mean, he pulled out of the first moto. So, you know, I think that's also, if you believe the rumours, going to affect his possible selection for the French team in the Motocross of Nations.
Well, I was talking to our French commentator for Motors, and he was saying that he already believes that he's out of the team. Out of the team. He's decided to withdraw himself from the team because of that. So if he's having to take time off now, and if there is a fracture, he won't ride next week in Faenza. Which means then he comes back for Teuchenthal, you know, 2 weeks later, and then it's back in the sand. There's no prep time for him.
And also, you know,
I think that's the right thing for him to do. Whereas, remember, last year there were all kind of fun and games surrounding him. And
he said he didn't want to ride last year.
And then he was drafted in when Frossard got hurt.
I think, you know, there's also factors kind of off the bike. I mean, him and Gauthier Paulin don't get along. In terms of team harmony, and France's best chance of making the podium at the 66th Motocross of Nations on September the 30th.
Is that what it is already? Wow.
I know. We've got a crazy month. 4 races in 5 weeks. But yeah, it's Christophe Porcel just losing third place in the championship today, and a slot on the Nations team, and still to confirm a ride for 2013. So it's, you know, after races like Brazil, Fermo at the beginning of the year, Bulgaria, you really would have thought Christophe would make a push for the championship. But, you know, a little bit the heart and the head is in the USA. I think he's going to try and find something there. And it's just a little bit of a shame that the season's petered off for him like that.
And had a conversation with him in Latvia, one of the few conversations I've been able to have with him this year, and he didn't seem to think that the points deficit from him in third in the championship at the time to Tony Cairoli was around 50, 55 points or something, wasn't going to be a problem, because there were circuits coming up on the calendar that he liked. Get, you know, Russia out of the way, that was the first plan, and then after that, you
hasn't
know,
worked like that,
Lockett, Mattoli Base, and here was always going to be tough. But the last two rounds in Faenza and Teuchenthal, and he really believed that he'd be in with a shout, you know, by the end of the season. But as you say, it's not really worked out for him. And, you know, I don't know really. I mean, the kid is a tremendous talent, but it's difficult to see where he can go at the moment, because, you know, he turned his back on America last year, or maybe there was nothing for him last year at the
probably
right price.
A bit of both.
You know, the price was too high. Maybe he wasn't prepared to drop, you know, the dollars and that kind of thing. So you hear, and maybe there was truth in it. Maybe he didn't want to ride the bike. I don't know. I wasn't there. And then obviously he came back, and that didn't go so well. And then this year you expect he's done his homework and he's going to springboard his way back into the US, and that's not happened either. So kind of in a little bit of no man's land at the moment, I think, for Christophe Porcel.
I mean,
which is a shame.
Yeah,
because somebody like that is not that old either. You know,
24, you, I think, 23.
He's still got 5 or 6 years left if he wants it.
Yeah, I think last year he could have even gone back into MX2, something crazy like that. You know, it's he's done a lot in his, you know, 5 or 6 years of his career. But, well, about to sneeze into the microphone. Something else, Paul, just before we talk about... Getting some strange gestures here in the press room. Just another thing before we start, have a quick chat about Faenza and close this second podcast for On Track Off Road. Max Anstey taking a second Grand Prix podium of his career and also a first for Honda since 2009, I think. That was quite
that would have been Mustang, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, he showed that he was the right selection for the Motocross Nation. I think that was a big part of a, maybe not a big part, but that was a slice of his motivation today for proving people that said, hey, listen, you know, I'm due a slot on this team. Wait till you see him on a 450. My Honda held together in MX2 class today in third position overall. It was a happy chap.
Yeah, he was. He's had a rough time of it lately, Max Anstey. But, yeah, I mean, first of all, he can ride sand. He was based out here for 3 or 4 years as a schoolboy. And actually, he made reference to it after the first race, post-race interview. Couldn't believe that he got lapped in third place by Geoffrey Herlings because he used to beat him around there on an 85, you know, back when they were kids. And obviously, times change. Part of that is down to, you know, Herlings' unbelievable talent riding in the sand, but also, you know, the Red Bull KTM. You know, we saw that with Van Horbeek as well, but even still.
But even though, Paul, I mean, Anstey decided to swap bumps and lumps for triples and quads and...
Yeah, but again, you know, he was picking his way. Again, it was the momentum for him, carrying him through in a similar way. Just didn't have the legs on Van Horbeek. So then that between those two, I think Max is probably a slightly better rider than Van Horbeek in the sand, but, you know, that was where the engine came into play, whereas Jeffrey's was the all-round package, great talent and a great engine beneath him. Obviously, going back to the Motocross of Nations, again, you know, looking at various posts out there at the moment, Sean Simpson with his, you know, sort of fifth overall, was he?
Fifth
today?
Overall, tenth in the world.
You know, a lot of people saying how smooth he rode, how smooth he looked. Big mistake for him to be overlooked over Max Anstey. Max Anstey being thought of as, you know, it was one race that got him the nod at Hawkstone Park, Max's British Championship a few weeks ago.
And Matt Lee was a bit of a disaster.
And sorry?
Matt Lee Basin was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, and, you know, but you know what? This whole nation selection for me takes me back to 1994 when, you know, the British team won. Obviously, we couldn't have foreseen what the outcome was going to be then, but Dave Thorpe, who was brought in as a team manager then, made a bold decision. I hadn't had the best 250 Grand Prix season. Rob Herring was hot and cold. Kurt Nickel was riding in 250s and, you know, was challenging for the World Championship with Greg Alberton and Stefan Evertz and those guys. I think he finished third in that year, maybe fourth. But when it came down to it, Dave Thorpe had a series of test days where he got the best 125 Grand Prix riders who were doing Grand Prix at the time. 250 selection, which would have been myself, Kurt, Rob, Rob Herring, of course, and then a couple of 500 guys in there as well. Max Anstey's dad, Mervyn Anstey, was one of those, and he'd won a 500 Grand Prix in Slovakia at Sverpec in the mud. And he obviously thought his place was on the team because he'd ridden 500 Grand Prix forever. He'd run a Grand Prix, but Dave made two bold decisions. One, by bringing Kurt Nickel into the team on a six-year-old bike, 500 HRC factory bike of Dave Thorpe's from, you know, what he won a world title on in 89, and or a five-year-old bike, and selecting me on the 125, Steve Dixon, who was my mechanic then, who is now the, you know, team owner for Monster Energy MX2 Yamaha, had prepared an engine. It wasn't Rinaldi spec or anything else like that. Steve was a very good, and still is a very good, engine tuner. And he produced this 125. We went on these test days, and I was quicker than the guys who were racing 125s. I was quicker than Paul Cooper, who was a very good 250 Grand Prix runner then, on the 125. He was on the 250. I was about a half a second slower than Kurt Nickel when he was on his 500, and about the same speed again as maybe Merv Anstey, or quicker than him on it around this particular venue.
So it's not always black and white and cut and dry, really.
No, exactly. You know, and sometimes a change is good, and we can all get very insular in going, right, he's doing good, he's doing good, he's doing good. They're the three guys that are doing the best in those three classes.
And he can only ride that bike.
And then he can only ride that bike. And so, you know, let's try an experiment. Let's look outside the box. And Neil Prince, and I think this could be controversial now, had Steve Dixon been the continued team manager for a fourth year,
he might have picked Sean.
He would have picked Sean.
Yeah.
Because, you know, his team boss, indirectly, obviously at the start of the year, he was the British Championship, the Yamaha connection, all the rest of it, and it's just easier logistically and all the rest of it. But then that's not the best reason to select your team. Yes, Sean can ride very well in the sand.
But Max, you can turn that around for Max Anstey and Honda, and the Honda connection there. But, you know, also, Paul, don't forget, I mean, your reasoning there and your explanation for thinking outside the box and trying something a little different is even being applied to the Americans.
Yeah.
Roger de Costa's obviously sat down and thought, well, hang on, we're going to... he knows Lommel,
he's
Belgian. He's going to be thinking, well, how can we try and, you know, take an eighth successive win? Put in Justin Barcia on a 450. It's been done before. He rode in the Nationals last year and did very well, but it's still a little bit of a punt into the unknown.
Yeah, I mean, Barcia, Bam Bam. I saw him ride in Paris-Bercy for the first time, you know, live last year. And again, he's a guy that
didn't take
a bit of a loose cannon. You know, he's very talented. Again, he's a strong rider. You know, Jeff Stanton, I think, trains with him, works with him, former AMA, and of course, Motocross Nations winner three times for the USA. And, you know, I read somewhere recently where he'd said, at the beginning when he first started working with him, you know, it's kind of normally give you maybe a month and, you know, before you sort of apply my methods and get where I'm coming from. It took him 2 months. And his parents were sort of, I think you're pushing him really hard. And he's like, really? I'm not even pushing him, you know? And so you get someone like Bam Bam, who we see as, you know, Mr. Panic Rev in the air, you know, revving the nuts off of a bike before he even lands anywhere. But he attacks, but he's not the fastest MX2 guy. But again, thinking outside the box. We've seen him ride a 450. James Stewart's out of the equation. But again, how much, in a similar way to the French, is James Stewart a distraction? And Roger de Costa knows that.
Yeah.
You know, does he want to be there or not? If you don't want to be there, don't even pack your bags, you know, and take the guys who really want to be there, and you're going to be somewhere there, you know. But that's the beauty about this race. You know, there's just so many unknowns. You know, Barcia, I think he could be the weak link in terms of, yes, he's very fast, but he could be the one that maybe crashes the most as well.
Well, we've got three races left this month, four weeks. We've got two GPs still to go before we get to the Nations. So we go to Faenza next. The first time we went there, I think it was a case of please help me find some shade, because it was burning. The second time we went for the Parts 1, some of the most joyous scenes I think I've seen for a championship celebration. And then we had the complete and utter washout of 2009. So, you know, we're going back to Italy, and then, you know, a week off, and then back to Germany. So, you know, it's going to be exciting stuff. I just want to say a big thanks for coming in and chewing some thoughts over with me here in Lierop, the Grand Prix of Benelux. And we'll make another podcast from Italy next week, and probably have some championships to dissect.
Possibly. And while we're talking about championships, let's not forget Mel Pocock, UEM, European 250, current points leader, can also wrap it up in a week's time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks.
Cheers, Anne. Bye.